Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso. Today, we have big news regarding community efforts to block placement of sexually violent predators at an East County home, so stay tuned. The county now has vaccines for teens as young as 12, and we'll have details. The governor has declared a drought in 41 counties, and all Californians are being asked to conserve water. We'll tell you how on today's show. And then on our Capitol Report, we'll have details on President Biden's lifting of a cap on refugee admissions. On Green Scene, hear why some Hakumba Hot Springs residents have concerns over a proposed solar energy project that would be larger than their community's downtown district. We'll also have news today on a vacancy on the Lemon Grove Planning Commission, new relief funds for restaurants, a big rig fire that claimed two lives near Pine Valley, and San Diego supervisors return to in-person meetings with limits. Today, we'll also be interviewing true crime author Caitlin Rother about her new book, Death on Ocean Boulevard, Inside the Coronado Mansion Case, which provides new details on the intriguing death of Rebecca Zahau. So stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters.
San Diego County's Board of Supervisors has unanimously approved a measure to increase public notification regarding locations of registered sex offenders and proposed placements of sexually violent predators in communities. Supervisor Joel Anderson introduced the measure, which was amended at the request of Supervisor Jim Desmond, to also include Native American communities. Anderson says that existing notifications do not provide adequate notice to communities where sex offenders will be located. In a written statement to the board, Anderson indicated that after sending questions to the district attorney and sheriff regarding the placement process and notification procedures, quote, "There are inconsistencies and omissions in the answers we received." He says that sex offenders were found to be residing illegally in his second district after a subcontractor forged an agreement with a homeowner to house 10 sex offenders in a living arrangement later found to be a violation of the county's zoning ordinance. Those offenders were ordered to vacate the property. But Anderson says, there is no way of preventing a similar situation from occurring in the future. Anderson has strenuously objected in recent public appearances to the disproportionate number of sexually violent predators placed in his district, while some other districts have none or very few. He has contended that this is unfair to East County, a generally poorer area than some wealthy enclaves that have not had any predator placements. Anderson's action comes in response to protests held by residents objecting the proposed placement of two sexually violent predators at a home on Horizon Hills Drive in unincorporated El Cajon near Mount Helix, a neighborhood with many children close to the site and a daycare center across the street. Both offenders Merle Wakefield and Douglas Badger have a history of violent sexual assaults on young people and both have been deemed likely to reoffend, yet inexplicably the state approved their conditional supervised release. A judge ruled this week against placing Wakefield at the site, finding it inappropriate for housing violent sex offenders, but a ruling is still pending from another judge on the second offender as of our show taping deadline. The measure adopted by supervisors directs county council and the chief administration officer to conduct a review and determine how to improve notification of the public. Anderson's measure also asks the district attorney to convene a meeting of the Sex Offender Management Council within 2 weeks. The council has not met since before the COVID-19 pandemic. The council is asked to appoint an executive director, fill several vacancies, and identify which county agency or program should consult with the state regarding housing for sexually violent predators slated for release. The council must also come up with new notification procedures for the public and potentially include advance notice for supervisors, the district attorney, and other community leaders, and provide opportunity for public input. Anderson's measure also calls for recommendations on any changes necessary to state law to improve public notification. The issue of dumping sexual predators in East County is one that former supervisor Diane Jacob also vocally objected to in testimony before judges on several proposed predator placements in areas including Hakumba, Campo, and Boulevard. During a community meeting in Hakumba this week, residents voiced interest in seeking a broader solution to the sexual predator issue to protect not only their community, but communities across the San Diego region. After hearing that supervisors approved Anderson's measure to increase notification to communities, one Hukumba resident fired back that a change in state law is needed, stating, "These people shouldn't be released into any communities." Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Angela Kurish.
This is Miriam Raftery with a health report. After the U.S. Food and Drug Administration and state health officials approved Pfizer's COVID-19 vaccine for 12 to 15-year-olds, San Diego County announced that it now has enough Pfizer vaccines to vaccinate all 175 youths in this age range in San Diego County. The vaccine for minors does require parental approval. Appointments are now available, and some walk-in clinics will also have the vaccine. But it's important to double-check that the location you plan to visit has the Pfizer vaccine, since some have other vaccines that are not approved yet for anybody under 18. There's more good news on the COVID front. Statewide, the positive rate of testing in California is only 1.1%, the lowest in the nation. San Diego's positive test rates in the past 2 weeks is just 1.6%, and only 1% on May 12th, the most recent date available. The county had only 94 new COVID-19 cases Thursday, the first time that new cases dipped below 100 a day in nearly a year. Dr. Wilma Wooten, the county public health official, says the vaccine, now available for those ages 12 and up, is an exciting milestone in efforts to help people get vaccinated. And she adds, already, nearly half of our 16 and older population in San Diego County have become fully vaccinated. This is going to allow our 12 to 15-year-old population to become protected as well and let them and their families feel safer.
After months of below-normal rainfall and one of the driest years on record, Governor Gavin Newsom has expanded his drought emergency proclamation to include 41 counties. San Diego is not included in the proclamation, which covers primarily northern and central California areas, representing about 30% of the state's population. However, all state residents are asked to help conserve water. Exceptionally warm temperatures in April and early May, driven by climate change, separate this critically dry year from all others on California record. The warm weather and very dry soils have further depleted runoff water from the Sierra snowpack, resulting in historic reductions in water flowing to major reservoirs. The drastic reduction in water supplies means these reservoirs have extremely low levels for water users, including farmers, also threatening fish and wildlife in counties the drought proclamation covers. Governor Newsom also announced $5.1 billion in funding for measures to address the drought and related water challenges. His proposal takes timely advantage of a massive $75.7 billion budget surplus due largely to wealthy Californians who profited during the pandemic. The governor's order directs the state water board to consider modifying requirements for reservoir releases to conserve water, and directs state water officials to expedite voluntary transfers of water from one water right holder to another, enabling available water to flow where it's needed most. Some communities have already adopted mandatory local water saving requirements, and many more have called for voluntary water use reductions. California's Natural Resources Agency Secretary Wade Crowfoot says, quote, "It's time for Californians to pull together once again to save water. All of us need to find every opportunity to save water where we can. Limit outdoor watering, take shorter showers, turn off the water while brushing your teeth, or washing dishes. For more tips on saving water, visit www.saveourwater.com. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Alexa Oslowski.
This is East County Magazine's Capital Report, bringing you the latest news and newsmakers from our nation's capital.
This is Mitchell Murphy with the Capital Report. President Joe Biden has announced the U.S. will raise the cap on refugee admissions to 62,500 for this fiscal year, up from the historic low of just 15,000 under the Trump administration. He also announced his intent to double that to 125,000 refugee admissions for the fiscal year 2022. President Biden says the Trump-era low cap did not reflect America's values as a nation that welcomes and supports refugees. There are an estimated 80 million displaced men, women, and children worldwide who are in immediate danger. They are fleeing wars, persecution, and other perils, according to the Jewish Family Services of San Diego, which was founded 103 years ago to help welcome refugees in our region. The announcement to lift the cap on refugees comes after Biden drew criticism from prominent Democrats and refugee advocates when he sought on signing an emergency declaration to raise the cap after concerns that it would take time to rebuild systems dismantled by the Trump administration. The hesitation also came amid heat from Republicans over the influx of migrants at the border. It's a myth, however, that lifting the cap will result in a massive flood of Central and South American migrants pouring in, since the executive order also breaks admissions down into regional allocations. That includes 22,000 slots for African refugees, 13,000 for Near East and South Asia, 6,000 for East Asia, 4,000 for Europe, and only 5,000 for Latin America and the Caribbean, plus a reserve of 12,500 not specifically allocated by geographic area. San Diego has long been a major hub for refugees, dating back to the post-Vietnam War era. In some recent years, San Diego has accepted the most refugees from around the world of any city in the U.S., including refugees from Africa, the Middle East, South and Central America. Michael Hopkins, the CEO of Jewish Family Services in San Diego, applauded Biden's announcement. He says, "We look forward to helping individuals and families from around the world rebuild their lives in San Diego in safety and with dignity." He adds, "Refugees and immigrants strengthen our social fabric and make San Diego and our country more prosperous and resilient in a changing world." The organization is asking for private donations to supplement government funding to boost staffing and help provide longer-term services for resettled refugees with permanent homes in San Diego, as well as volunteers to help new refugees. Such supplemental aid is needed, even if President Biden acknowledges that achieving 62,500 refugee admissions is a goal that may not be met this year. Biden says, "We are working quickly to undo the damage of the last 4 years. It will take some time, but the work is already underway." The president adds, "We might not make it this year, but we are going to use every tool available to help these fully vetted refugees fleeing horrific conditions in their home countries." David Milbrand, CEO of the International Rescue Committee, another major organization aiding refugees locally, also welcomed Biden's actions. He told CNN, "When America welcomes refugees, it is the best of America. Leading on its distinguished tradition and long-held values of providing refuge to those fleeing violence and political persecution." San Diego's Democratic Congresswoman, Sarah Jacobs, also praised the decision to raise the cap. She concludes, "We have a moral obligation to provide safety and security to refugees fleeing violence and humanitarian crisis. I'm glad that the president lifted the unthinkably low cap set by the previous administration and look forward to working together to reach 125,000 refugee admissions next year."
La Mesa City Council last month passed a resolution proposed by Councilmembers Jack Hsu and Bill Baber to improve vaccine equity by June 19th, also known as Juneteenth. Councilmember Hsu shared San Diego County data, which showed that members of the Black community are being vaccinated at much lower rates than others. Hsu says the city needs to close that gap so that we don't have a difference between people who are protected by color, by ethnicity, by income, or by where you live. Juneteenth is a historic date that marks the official end of slavery, when Union soldiers arrived in Texas to deliver the news 2.5 years after the Emancipation Proclamation was signed. Hsu hopes to partner with community leaders and organizations like faith groups, educational institutions, and businesses to facilitate spread of information about the vaccine to groups that may be struggling to access resources and to assure that nobody in La Mesa is left behind. The resolution passed unanimously back in April. Now, as part of its vaccine equity goal, the City of La Mesa will host a vaccine clinic on May 22nd at Helix Charter High School from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. That's in partnership with the county, Champions for Health, and the Philippine Nurses Association of San Diego. For those who require assistance, drive-up appointments will be available. First or second dose appointments can be made by calling 619-667-1322 Monday through Friday from 8 a.m. to noon, or by visiting cityoflamesa.us/COVID-19. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Miriam Raftery.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, in the heart of San Diego's East County.
Now it's time for the Green Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community.
This is Alexa Oslowski with a Green Screen Report. Residents in Hakumba Hot Springs are shining a light on their concerns about the proposed Hakumba Valley Ranch solar project, which includes a 643-acre solar energy facility on 1,200 acres of land. That's six times the size of Hakumba's downtown district. Residents of this high desert town along the U.S.-Mexico border in San Diego's East County held a community meeting on Friday, May 7th. The event was held in person since many in this remote enclave lack access to high-speed internet, and the county only allows the town's planning group to hold virtual meetings. More than 50 people showed up, around a tenth of the town's population based on the last census. Cherry Diefenbach and Jeffrey Osborne, two members of the Hakumba Sponsor Group, the town's official county planning entity, addressed those assembled. Diefenbach noted that Hakumba is located within the Mountain Empire sub-regional plan, adding, quote, "Under our plan, this community wants respect for the environment. This community does not want large industrial projects, green energy or otherwise, in our town. Concerns include glare, noise made by solar trackers, loss of natural terrain and community character, as well as loss of tourism, all for power to be sold to SDG&E and sent to San Diego." Diefenbach added bluntly, quote, "Nothing in this project is a hoot for anyone who lives here." She noted that in other places, developers have given back to communities impacted by energy projects, such as donating a generator for a town or putting power lines underground. The Hakumba Sponsor Group earlier voted to support a 200-acre solar project north of homes and well away from the scenic highways, but the proposed project is much larger. So, the group will meet again on May 18th via Zoom to hold a vote on the actual project proposal. Their vote is merely advisory. If approved by the County Planning Commission and supervisors, the full project would include 300,000 solar cells that would generate an estimated 90 megawatts of green energy for the next 35 years or more. Each array of panels would measure up to 300 feet long and stand 12 feet above the ground, higher than a 6-foot fence planned to protect views. In some areas, the panels would just be 65 feet away from homes. Solar panels would be within 300 feet of the community center and park. That setback was originally only 45 feet, though the developer agreed to increase that distance. The site would also include 75 lithium-ion batteries, two inverters, and a transformer on skids. Fencing would be topped by barbed wire, with landscaping to try and lessen visual impacts. Panels would also surround Hakumba's glider port on three sides, raising concerns over student pilot safety and visual blight. Diefenbach said, quote, "People come here because it's scenic. We don't want to discourage anyone from coming to Hakumba. We want to encourage revitalization of our town and our businesses." Of the total 1,200 acres, the solar panels would cover 643 acres. Another 435 acres would be dedicated as open space as mitigation to protect sensitive species. 280 acres have not yet had a usage designated. The project would require over a year to complete. The workers would not live on site and no permanent jobs would be created. The site includes a former organic farm that went fallow after a well ran dry, and after complaints over an eye gnat infestation tied to the farm. Still, Diefenbach notes that loss of prime farmland is a concern, as is lost opportunity for other land uses, such as new homes or a border crossing. Another issue is the increased risk of wildfires that construction crews and electrical lines bring to this isolated part of San Diego County. Diefenbach said, quote, "We only have two firefighters on site in Hakumba. There are no plans to increase that. Even with 500 people building the solar project, the population would double with no extra firefighting." Jeffrey Osborne, the new owner of the Hakumba Hot Springs Resort and Spa, as well as a planning group member, spoke next. He announced that he and his partners moved here to restore the spa and revitalize the town to its glory days in the 1920s and 30s. The spa is undergoing a major remodel and Lake Hakumba is also being rehabbed. But revitalization efforts may founder if the tourists on whom Hakumba relies on stop coming due to massive solar arrays and power lines marring the desert scenery that draws visitors here. Osborne declared, quote, "This solar project is something I think we need to fight." But opposing all green energy projects isn't a winning strategy, he believes, since California aims to convert to all green energy by 2025. Instead, he wants to see a scaled-back project that protects community character and keeps the solar footprint away from downtown Hukumba, while also having the town accept its fair share of green power. Residents in this and other rural towns want to see that responsibility shared by all communities, rather than dumping industrial energy projects in East County's small towns and open spaces. Stephanie Sathoff, a PR professional who previously coordinated groups to successfully block the Newland Sierra housing development in North County, is part of a team now working to ensure equitable treatment for residents in Hukumba Hot Springs. She says the goal is, quote, balancing the importance of solar with this community's quality of life and cultural concerns. Next up, the Hukumba Sponsor Group will meet via Zoom on Tuesday, May 18th, to vote on whether to recommend approval, conditional approval, or denial of the project. According to Diefenbach, representatives from the county and the developer, JVR LLC, plan to be present. The final environmental impact report on the project is due out in late June. The County Planning Commission would meet as early as July 9th, which would provide another opportunity for community members to speak out. Supervisors could vote on the Hukumba Solar Project as soon as August 18th. Residents and others who care about Hukumba were urged to contact their county supervisors. Diefenbach told Hukumba residents that whether the project will be built as is, modified, or rejected will likely come down to, quote, how much pushback there is and whether we roll over or not.
If you want to stay in development projects in Lemon Grove, here's your opportunity. The city has a vacancy on its planning commission, and it's seeking to appoint a new planning commissioner. Applications must be received by Monday, June 7th at 5 p.m. Interviews will be conducted at the June 15th City Council meeting. The position pays $50 a meeting for each commissioner present. The appointee will serve a 4-year term from July of this year through July 2025. Applicants must be 18 or older, live, and be registered to vote in the City of Lemon Grove when your application is submitted. To apply, you can submit an application in person at Lemon Grove City Hall or mail it in. For more information, you can contact the City Clerk's Office at 619-824-3841. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
The American Rescue Plan signed into law by President Joe Biden includes a restaurant revitalization fund to help food and beverage industry businesses offset losses from the COVID-19 pandemic. Owners can apply now for the Restaurant Revitalization Fund through the U.S. Small Business Administration at restaurants.sba.gov. Again, that address is restaurants.sba.gov. The fund is open not only to restaurants, but also caterers, bars, bakeries, wineries, breweries, distillery food carts, inns, and certain other businesses where food sales provided a major source of revenues. Congresswoman Sarah Jacobs, who championed the bill in Congress, says small businesses are the backbone of our community and our economy, adding that they deserve more help to make it through this pandemic. She adds that she is proud to fight to help small business owners and support the Restaurant Revitalization Fund, which will help keep businesses open, workers on payroll, and our economy back on track. The Restaurant Revitalization Fund will provide restaurants and other eligible businesses with funding equal to their pandemic-related revenue loss up to $10 million per business. The relief does not have to be repaid, provided that the funds are put toward eligible uses by March of next year. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Angela Kurish.
A big rig truck careened off of Interstate 8 Wednesday night near the Sunrise Highway exit in East County and burst into flames. CAL FIRE, the California Highway Patrol, and Border Patrol responded to the scene and found the body of the driver who was trapped inside. He has not yet been identified. 17 hours later, cleanup crews found the body of a second man who was also unidentified. The collision also damaged a bridge and shut down the highway. The California Highway Patrol is seeking witnesses to this tragic crash. If you have any information, you can call the CHP's El Cajon office at 619-401-2000. Again, that number is 619-401-2000. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso in the heart of San Diego's East County.
For more than a year, the County Board of Supervisors has held virtual meetings. But now, as COVID-19 restrictions ease up, supervisors are once again allowing limited in-person attendance starting May 18th and 19th. But only 22 members of the public will be allowed into the board's chamber at a time due to social distancing. Others can watch from an overflow room across the hall or wait for space to become available. Now, if you attend in person, masks are still required, along with temperature checks and security screenings. You can also still watch meetings live online and make a request to speak via teleconference or send in written comments via email. The meetings will still be streamed live, and you can access them on the Supervisor's Agenda web stream page, as well as on Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and Vimeo. Meetings also air on Cox Channel 24 or 19, depending where you live, and Spectrum Channels 24 and 85. Now, if you don't have internet access, you could also call in to listen to your supervisor's meetings at 619-531-4716. For more information, you can visit the San Diego County Supervisor's website. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery. The East County Magazine Show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interests, not special interests. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. Now stay tuned for part two of the East County Magazine radio show.
Welcome to Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read. My name is Raina Menashe, and I'll be your host for this segment.
This is Miriam Raftery, guest hosting Bookshelf this week on the East County Magazine radio show. Today, I am speaking with our special guest, true crime author Caitlin Rother, about her new book, Death on Ocean Boulevard, Inside the Coronado Mansion Case. My guest, who spent 20 years as a Pulitzer-nominated investigative journalist, is also a TV crime commentator. She has authored or co-authored 14 books, several Kindle ebooks, and contributed to a COVID-19 anthology. This new book is a true crime narrative about the case of Rebecca Zahau, whose death in 2011 gripped our city and country for an entire decade. Welcome, Caitlin. It's a pleasure having you on Bookshelf.
Thanks for having me back.
Our pleasure. Well, let's start by talking about Rebecca's death at the Spreckles Mansion 10 years ago. In your view, Caitlin, how has the story of what happened to her become such a compelling mystery?
Well, to start with, the condition that her body was found in was very bizarre and very unusual. When women typically commit suicide, if that's what this was, they tend to do it in a nonviolent way. So they'll take pills and go to sleep. They don't generally hang themselves. And this is the only case that anybody involved in this case had ever heard of where a woman was hanging naked. On top of that, Rebecca was also had her hands bound behind her back and her ankles bound together. And on top of that, as if that wasn't enough, she was hanging outside, which is also very, you know, just unheard of. And she had a gag in her mouth. So there's a t-shirt that was wrapped around her head on top of the hanging rope, which was on top of her hair.
So it just defies logic.
Yeah. So the state of her body is one thing. Then, you know, it happens in a historic landmark, the Spreckles Mansion, which was built in 1908 by John D. Spreckles, who was the richest man in the county, and his family was the richest in the state of California. So that's unusual. Rebecca was also involved with a very rich man as well in real time, Jonas Shacknai, who owned a pharmaceutical corporation at the time. And then on top of that, you have Jonah's brother who came to stay at the guest house, who is a tugboat captain from Memphis. So, and he's pretty eccentric. So you've got this cast of characters, you've got a historic landmark, and you've got this very unusual death.
Yeah, Agatha Christie couldn't have set it up any better. Well, Caitlin, that's all very fascinating. Can we talk about some of the unanswered questions and holes in this suicide theory, as well as the murder theories that have been put forward? And the sheriff, by the way, for the record, did find that it was a suicide, correct?
Yes.
Tell us what was not addressed by the sheriff's investigation. You know, what are some of the evidence and collection methods that outside observers have criticized?
So, as you said, the sheriff's department ruled Rebecca's death a suicide. They had a short investigation of about 7 weeks. And some people think that that was rushed. Some people questioned the validity of that because, as we just discussed, this is so unusual and so bizarre, you know, that the sheriff's department didn't really do itself any favors by keeping so many details and you know, much of what their rationale was for this finding. And they said, well, we're trying to protect the Zahau family and, you know, their privacy, and we don't want to re-traumatize this family. But, you know, a lot of people just didn't buy this, including the Zahaus. Well, so the Zahaus think that, you know, she was murdered. They just don't buy this. And so a lot of questions have been raised because, you know, and I'm not taking a position in this case. So I don't believe that it's clear either way, whether it's a suicide or a murder, because of these questions. So starting with the suicide, if it was a suicide, why wasn't she decapitated, or at least partially decapitated? The injuries in her neck are fractured cartilages. Now, if you're going to drop over a railing by 9 feet, you know, the experts testified at the civil trial where the jury found Adam Shacknai responsible for Rebecca's death. The Zahau's experts testified, a couple of them, that the injuries in her neck just did not match the story of how she died.
Would they have matched if it had been a murder? How would that have happened?
Well, according to these experts, the injuries in her neck were more consistent with being strangled and then having somebody lower her over the edge, because usually when somebody's, this is called a long fall drop or a long drop. Normally when somebody hangs themselves, it's over a door, or you step off a chair, you fall 1 or 2 feet. So
you don't fling yourself over a railing and just leave a paw print.
Right. So that's number one. Number two, there's some imprints on the balcony floor. There's dust and dirt, and there were some marks that the sheriff's crime lab criminalists said were toe prints. Well, there are different experts on the outside who've looked at those toe prints. And one expert says, well, I actually see another set of prints on top of her prints.
Oh.
And there's only one little toe or one big toe, one print near the railing. How is she going to, you know, 110 pounds, how is she going to throw herself over the railing by leveraging all her weight on one toe with her hands behind her back and her ankles bound? So how did she learn how to tie those elaborate knots that were around her wrists and her ankles? And the sheriff's department says, well, it was very easy. We have this female deputy. We're going to show you how it could have been done. But there's a house knot tying expert during the trial said, those are not the same knots. Those were way too simple. They were not tied the same way. These are the knots that I saw on her body. And he did this elaborate demonstration on a mannequin in the courtroom, which was just, I was boggled at how complicated those knots were. So, you know, there's evidence, and then there are interpretations of the evidence. And the sheriff's department's investigation, a lot of people feel, just did not satisfy them. Why would she even kill herself that way? Now, by the same token, on the murder side, the sheriffs say, why would someone kill her that way? Why would they draw so much attention to this death? Why not just put a gun in her hand and make it look like she shot herself? Why is there no DNA or fingerprints at the scene other than Rebecca's? If someone killed her, why isn't there, you know, some evidence that a killer was there? Well, the house claim that the scene was wiped down, that the killer wore gloves, because there was a knife that Adam even admitted to using to cut her down, and his DNA wasn't on that knife either.
That's thing, isn't it?
So there are these Adam was the brother. The contrary facts of the matter don't even match up.
No, now there was a really bizarre note that was scrawled on the door, on the wall. Mm-hmm. Refresh our memories about what that said, and what's your take on that?
So there was a message on the bedroom door where the hanging rope for the bed that Rebecca's hanging rope was anchored. And on the door, it was in black paint in big block letters. It said, she saved him. Can you save her? Now, There are actually two deaths in this story. And so this is important. So within 48 hours before Rebecca's body was found by Adam Shacknai, who called 911 and said, "I got a girl hung herself in the guest house," even though he later said he was the one in the guest house, that she was in the main house. There was a little boy, Max, who was 6 years old, and he had a tragic fall two mornings earlier. Jonah's son with his second wife, Dina Shacknai. And Rebecca claimed that she was downstairs in the bathroom when she heard this loud crash and a dog barking, her dog. She came out. She said she found this little boy lying on the floor, not breathing. His heart wasn't beating. There was a broken glass chandelier lying next to him, broken glass all over the floor, which had previously been above them on the second floor ceiling, and a soccer ball and a razor scooter. So her little sister was there, 13-year-old sister who was visiting, and she asked her sister to call 911. In the meantime, she told Jonah that she gave Max some breaths to start CPR. By the time the paramedics came, the doctors finally brought him back at the hospital. He'd been down for 25 or 30 minutes. Mm. But what most people believe that that note refers to is that she saved him, meaning she tried to give him CPR and was able to bring him back at least. You know, so he was hooked up to machines though. And he wasn't dead when she was found dead. He was declared brain dead a couple days after that. But that's what the first part of the message appears to be referring to. Now, the second part of the message, can you save her? That's the part people really want to argue about, because if it's a suicide note, why is it written in the third person? Why is it written in this angry, taunting tone?
Yeah.
Why are the paint marks, you know, the letters are written, you know, it's not pretty. It's not like it's calligraphy. It looks kind of angry.
You're saying it doesn't look like her handwriting? Was there an analysis done?
There was an analysis done by the Zuhauz expert, who the defense spent almost an entire day in a hearing outside of the jury's presence to try to keep him out. And then they did a very, very long cross-examination trying to put holes in his statements, which basically said that it was more likely Adam's painting these letters than it was Rebecca, which is a pretty low standard because it's civil court.
Yeah.
Because he said the A's and the M's looked more like his letters. Now, Adam signs his name in capital letters, just coincidentally.
The plot thickens. So I understand they didn't collect Adam's phone or phone records to even back up his story about where he said he was and when. What was his alibi, and why do you think the sheriff was, what sounds like, frankly, sloppy in not collecting those basic records?
Well, there are a number of outside experts, and they've pretty much all said, why didn't the sheriff's department collect Adam's phone? I mean, it seems like kind of an obvious thing to do. And I honestly don't know why they didn't do it. I asked him that myself. I never got a good answer.
Yeah.
They did get Jonah's phone records. They did get Rebecca's phone records. They were able to see that Jonah called Rebecca and left her a voicemail at 12:50 a.m., the morning that she was found. So Adam found her and called 911 at 6:48 a.m. And Jonah says he left her a voicemail and he was crying on the phone and basically said, reporting what the doctor had told him and Max's mother, that Max, the best scenario was that Max would never walk or talk again. And Jonah told me, I interviewed him 8 times by Skype for a couple hours each time, right after I thought I had finished writing the entire book. I had to redo a whole bunch of it because I got him finally. I thought he was very important and to have his perspective in the book. But he told me that he really wished that he hadn't left her that message. He wished that he had just said, call me back, because he feels like that contributed. And that's what the sheriff said. The sheriff said that the reason they're saying it was suicide is because she was distressed and troubled and felt guilty about what had happened to Max, because she was the only adult in the house at the time, and that she felt guilty. Now, there's a house say she never said that. She'd never you know, threatened to commit suicide before. She wasn't depressed. The sheriff said, no. Well, yes, she was.
Well, because
there's
back-
some okay. notes on her phone that they were able to get. Unfortunately, they were not able to get that voicemail. So
but there were no, she didn't leave a suicide note, to be clear.
Well, I guess the sheriff's department believes that that note on the door is her suicide note.
Even though the handwriting didn't seem to match. Very interesting. There was also a polygraph test that Adam took. And I understand the results were somewhat conflicting on that. Tell us about that.
Well, so Adam did take a polygraph, which is a voluntary thing, I believe. Yeah, I don't think they can make you. And they also don't, it's not usable in court, but it is an investigative tool that investigators, detectives do use. And the results, according to the sheriff's examiner, were inconclusive. However, he determined that Adam was telling the truth.
Based on, based on inconclusive results?
Yeah. So I guess, you know, they look at other things too, body language, maybe, I don't know. But that was his determination. And outside experts said, well, they should have done another test, number one. And number two, when they looked at the results, and, you know, these are, you know, they're sine waves or sound waves. I don't know what they look at, but I guess they can see emotion in, you know, in these waves. And they read the test as Adam was being deceptive. So not only was it not, was he not telling the truth? He was being deceptive.
Yeah, very interesting. Can you comment on the DNA evidence? I understand there were some questions about the methodology that was used for collecting that.
Well, according to the Zahaus expert, the DNA expert that they had testified during the trial, there were at least 12 places where she thought there should have been DNA, that there wasn't any DNA. And that's why the Zahaus attorney, Keith Greer, said he felt that the area had been wiped down. Now, the defense and the sheriff's department say, well, you can't selectively wipe away DNA from one person and not from another.
But if it was suicide, why would she have wiped down the DNA? And she certainly couldn't have done that after she was dead. So it just doesn't seem to make sense to me.
Well, the point is her DNA was there. So they're not saying Rebecca would have wiped it down or not wiped it down, but Rebecca's DNA was there and her fingerprints were there. And the sheriff's department is saying you can't selectively choose whose DNA you're going to wipe away. If somebody had wiped it away, her DNA would be gone too.
I see. So that would sort of argue more toward the suicide theory and not the murder theory. Interesting. There are a lot of unanswered questions here regarding the sheriff's investigation of Rebecca's death and how it occurred at the home of her billionaire boyfriend. Caitlin, what part did power and corruption play, if any, in this whole scenario, according to what you have learned over the years?
Well, one thing that Jonah and I kind of laughed about was that he has become a billionaire in this case, when in fact, he's actually only a millionaire. There's a lot of people have called him a billionaire, but he's actually, it's okay. A lot of it's been on the news wrong too. So he owned a pharmaceutical corporation, Medicis, and news of this peculiar, bizarre, and elaborate death apparently affected his stock prices. And he was very concerned about his business. And he told the detectives that. So in one of the, he did two interviews with the detectives, and you can even hear it on the tape where he says, look, can you just publicly state that I'm not a suspect? Because this is really hurting my business and, you know, et cetera. So people have said, well, Jonah's really rich. This death doesn't make sense as a suicide to us. So we think that, you know, Jonah's wealth must have had undue influence. And in fact, one of the Zahaus early attorneys made that statement on TV and ended up getting a cease and desist order from Jonah's attorney. So he has vehemently denied this. The Zahaus believe, though, that the sheriff shared information with Jonah that he didn't share with them. They believe there was some sort of, you know, favorable treatment. They've believed that there's racial discrimination, that they didn't really see Rebecca for who she really was. And they painted her as this terrible person and sick person and crazy person. And so they have alleged that also that it seems so clear to them that even the civil judge in one of her last rulings said, you know, that the sheriff's investigation left as many questions unanswered as it answered, and that it's perfectly fair and reasonable to question who killed Rebecca Zahau. So the Zahaus are saying, well, if even this judge believes that there was enough evidence here to uphold this jury verdict that Adam Shacknai was responsible for Rebecca's death, there's got to be something to this. They want this case reopened and the criminal case reopened. But as of today, there is not enough forensic evidence to meet the criminal threshold.
Right.
So they have sued the sheriff's department recently, last year. So there's like another civil suit pending, this time against the sheriff's department, though. So the first one was against Adam Shacknai and originally against Dina Shacknai, the Max's mother and her sister. They were ultimately dismissed. So today it's now against the sheriff's department, and they're trying to get records to try to get more evidence that the sheriff's department either was, you know, holding things back or had some kind of ulterior motive, that they did things wrong during the investigation, because they're just trying to do anything they can to get this thing reopened.
Yeah, which is understandable. We should jump in and note here that Sheriff Gore has gone on record, I understand, denying that he accepted any
yes,
bribes,
absolutely,
or any undue influence. Right. You've said there were no campaign contributions that you could,
right,
document.
Right. So I went and looked at the campaign donations, because if you remember Strippergate with the San Diego City Councilman,
oh, yeah,
I covered that too when I was at the paper. Michael Zucchet was acquitted for this, but Ralph Enzinza went to prison. And this was because they accepted campaign donations for a, you know, alleged quid pro quo, doing favors or whatever. So this is, you know, illegal. However, there are no campaign donations on Sheriff Gore's statements. And he said, you know, he was highly offended. He's never done anything wrong. And he told me that he thought that Jonah was actually, you know, the biggest victim in this case, because he lost his son and he lost his girlfriend.
Yeah.
And so
he was double victimized in a sense. I mean, you do feel sorry for him, millions and all. He still, mm-hmm, that's a terrible loss for anybody too.
So they both deny that. They both deny that there was any favorable treatment, special treatment, or any kind of collusion or corruption, whatever.
Yeah. So if there may have been concerns about Jonah perhaps suing over, you know, lost value to his business or his stocks, it's kind of ironic that now the sheriff is being sued not by Jonah, but by the Zahau family for perhaps rushing the
investigation. That's an excellent point.
Interesting. Now, Caitlin, in some ways, it must have been exceptionally difficult for you to write this. You've certainly covered many other true crime stories in the past, but in the book, you explain your own painful insight into the topic of suicide. How did your personal experience losing your husband to suicide impact your writing and your investigation in this case?
Well, I was drawn to this case, obviously, like everyone else, because of the bizarre circumstances of Rebecca's death and the fact that it, you know, was at this house and had these eccentric characters and these rich people and so much sympathy for the Zahau family as well. So I always am drawn to these stories that have such high emotions, that have such inherent conflict in them. But I was also drawn to this case because my husband hung himself. And I know that as a fact. The Zahau family, you know, was taken by surprise and said this absolutely positively could never have happened. My husband threatened to commit suicide repeatedly, and he did it as a manipulative tactic to get me to give him more attention and what have you. I, you know, Rebecca never threatened that. She never talked about being depressed. My husband was diagnosed as being depressed. My husband was actually diagnosed as being borderline personality disorder. However, as I got into this story, I started seeing some parallels in their behaviors, and I'm not trying to diagnose Rebecca as having the same disorder, but I, mm-hmm, like I said, I did see some parallels by doing interviews with Michael Berger, who was an old boyfriend of hers. This came out just briefly in court, which is how my curiosity got piqued. Oh, I tracked him down and interviewed him repeatedly. He said that, you know, he was seeing Rebecca, didn't know that she was still married. She told him she was going through a divorce. She wasn't wearing a ring. Mm-hmm. She started, you know, dating him. And, you know, it turns out all these years later, he you know, didn't realize she'd never even filed any paperwork.
Oh my.
So she was still married. She was still living with her husband, telling this boyfriend of hers that she was going through a divorce. And then she disappeared one day. They were living together and she disappeared, didn't show up at work. And she started calling him and saying, you know, she's crying and they took me. He says, who took you? They took me and they're driving me around in a, you know, they've got something over my eyes. And he says, well, where are you? She says, I don't know. I don't know where I am. Huh. Sounds like a bathroom. So it turns out she, we still don't know exactly what happened, but Michael Berger was convinced that she had been kidnapped because she was crying on the phone. And I said, you know, that sounds an awful lot like something that happened to me. My husband disappeared one night and I couldn't find him. And he came home and he said, the police took me and they, you know, they took my, took me and did a cavity search and did it. And I was just, he was crying and I was just like, wow.
So maybe some kind of psychotic break that they may.
Well, but my point is there's like a pattern of behaviors of telling different stories to different people that Rebecca did. My husband and she both were arrested for shoplifting in Phoenix, not at the same time. They both went through the same diversion program. So, you know, she wasn't an addictive personality. She didn't have that, but she did have some depression. She left these notes on her phone that showed she couldn't sleep. She wasn't eating. She was very upset at Jonah. Their relationship was in trouble. He didn't want to have children. She did. So, you know, I think there's a lot more to this story than we really know. And I think her family really saw her a certain way. And by doing these interviews with these other people, I was able to bring out a whole other side of Rebecca. And I don't think I would have known any of that or seen that without having happened to me, what happened to me. And I was able to discuss these behaviors that I saw in my husband with Jonah and with Michael Berger, and not to paint Rebecca as a, you know, bad person, but there, I think she was a troubled person. And I think that, you know, she had a traumatic life too. She had been molested when she was young. Mm-hmm. She was a political refugee. They were very poor. She had food issues. She was obsessed with working out and she wasn't sleeping. She was upset. So anyway,
well, certainly after the death of the little boy that was in her care at the time, that's certainly understandable, but you're right. One could certainly make a case either way for suicide or murder. And we may never know, you know, the truth in this case. It's just one of those intriguing and tragic mysteries, really. You dedicated your book to Rebecca and Max. Why?
Because I think what gets lost in all of this is, you know, it's a story. It's a debate. People are arguing over this evidence. And I think what gets lost is the fact that we've got two people who are dead. And that is a tragedy, no matter how either one of them died. Rebecca was a loved sister and daughter to her family, and they are still grieving her loss. And Max's family, his parents are still grieving his loss. I don't know that that's ever something that you can get over. And so it's not a parlor game to kind of figure this out. It is a mystery and it is a big story, but by the same token, I just want to make sure that people don't forget the tragedy and the loss of these two people. And I wanted to pay a tribute to them.
I understand that you have a book signing coming up on May 16th, for those of you that are listening to our Friday show. Can you tell us the details, where people can see you, and if you have any other future events, real or virtual, planned?
Absolutely. The book signing is actually going to be my first and maybe only book signing in person. I didn't know. I had to plan this whole book launch and book tour virtually because of COVID. And thankfully, I was able to get my second shot a couple of weeks ago. So this was actually my first opportunity to do an in-person signing. So we're going to do it outside, though. Be safe. And I'm not going to talk. I'm just going to sign books. Mm-hmm. So we're not going to have a crowd. It's just going to be, you know, one person at a time.
And where is it?
And it's at Bay Books in Coronado from 12 to 2 p.m. Sunday, the May 16th. And then I have a virtual event actually on Saturday, the day before, this Saturday, May 15th, for anybody who wants to join a discussion, I've got an online virtual event with a bookstore in Prescott, Arizona, but it doesn't matter where you are. Right. And the details are on my website. It's caitlinrother.com. If you go to my blog, I've got a virtual tour calendar, and I have other virtual events planned for next week. And I have all the links to all the recorded virtual events I've already done. So if you want to know more, you want to hear more Q&A or read stories or hear me talk about it some more. If this wasn't enough for you, there's more.
Okay. Well, one last question, Caitlin. What are you working on next? And when can we expect to see that?
Well, thanks to COVID, I lost a book contract for a book that I had been working on for a whole year. I was very disappointed. It was on the San Diego Zoo's Frozen Zoo. And I do hope that that will be reinstated at some point when the zoo gets back on its feet financially, because I think it's a fascinating book. But I was really upset about that. And I had to keep myself busy. So I immediately started writing a crime novel. And so I wrote like 120,000 words in a couple months. I mean, I was just went crazy. I'm like, well, I got to do something. I'm locked here in this house. So I have one novel that's out already. I only have one, and it's called Naked Addiction. It's set in La Jolla and PB. It took me 17 years to get published because it was the first book that I ever wrote. I had to rewrite it a lot of times because I didn't really know what I know now. After writing 14 books, 11 of them true crime books, I now really know my stuff about homicide investigations and detectives and all that. So this is a sequel to Naked Addiction, and it also takes place in La Jolla, in the La Jolla Farms area, and there are two mysterious deaths. You know, it's about the wealthy. It's about sex and murder and drugs at the beach. Just like that's my theme for this series. So, and I'm hoping to have it.
A lot of that in San Diego.
Yeah, hoping it's going to come out later this year. I do have a publisher for it. I just need to make sure that I get it done, because this book tour is taking a lot of time and I haven't been able to get back to, I haven't quite finished it yet. I'm still editing it.
I understand you were also working on a book about the McStay case, the family that went missing and was found murdered. What's the status on that?
Well, COVID pretty much sidelined that project. I was able to chip away at it. I did some interviews. It took me months to get a court order to go look at the exhibits and, you know, make copies and stuff. But I just still didn't feel like it was safe to go to the courthouse. And so I've been chipping away at that. But I had hoped to get that further along. But COVID sidelined that. That's still on the burner. It's just a slow burner. So, yeah, I am still working on that.
Well, Caitlin, we are out of time for today, but it's been a delight talking with you about your new book, Death on Ocean Boulevard, Inside the Coronado Mansion Case. For more information on Caitlin and her books, you can visit her website at caitlinrother.com. That's CAITLINROTHER.com. Again, this is Miriam Raftery, guest hosting for Raina Menashe on today's East County Magazine's Bookshelf segment, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read.
This concludes today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technician, Jonathan Getz, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Corey Clement, Royalty Free Music, and Pond 5. If you would like to underwrite or sponsor the East County Magazine radio show, or get involved as a volunteer on our public interest news show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We'll be back soon with another edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show.